Between Heaven and Earth, a podcast presented by the German Association for Chinese Medicine, AGTCM. This podcast on applied channel theory was recorded at the TCM Congress Rothenburg 2024. Lucia Dei interviewed Jonathan Chang at the Dao Cafe. Unfortunately, the middle part was lost due to a technical problem, but we hope you will enjoy this anyway.
Okay, so with that, welcome everybody. This is at the Dao Cafe with Jonathan Chang. John is a practitioner from Beijing, and you know him. I don't know if you know John. He was a student of Dr. Wang Jiyi, who was a very critical Chinese practitioner in terms of developing the applied channel theory. And we're going to talk more about that in a minute. And John graduated from the Beijing Chinese Medicine University in 2012?
I finished it 2012.
Okay, 2012, and he's been having a practice. You've been running a practice in Beijing for a couple of years now, right?
I've been working at a private clinic in Beijing. It's called the Linglan TCM Clinic. But they also do a lot of online teaching, online teaching, but also a lot of training programs too. So it's partly an educational company, but also has a clinic too.
Okay, yeah, great. So welcome, John.
Okay.
John's going to teach some courses tomorrow and on Friday as well. And I thought first to just kind of talk a bit about, Wang Jiyi and the whole applied channel theory approach, especially since maybe not all of the people here know about it. So I read in your bio that applied channel theory is Jingluo Yixue, right? So what Dr. Wang really tried to do was doing classical texts and fusing that with clinical application. So I thought it would be nice to start elaborating on what that looked like exactly, trying to build a bridge between ancient texts and the demands of clinical modern practice.
So I guess if we just go all the way back to the beginning, or not the beginning, but a beginning. So when Dr. Wang, he was part of the first graduating class of the Beijing University of Chinese Medicine. At that time, it was like the Beijing College of Chinese Medicine. And so when he was in school, that was the time, it was a very special time in Chinese, modern history, because they were just established these universities in China. At that time, there were only four, so one was in Beijing. So at that time, there were a lot of renowned practitioners who were invited to teach at that school. So people like Qingbo Wei, or nowadays there are people who we're familiar with, Ren Yingqiu, who did research on the different schools of thought of Chinese medicine. And then there were also some Shaolin practitioners like Liu Duzhou, who's quite popular nowadays, or Hu Xishu. So all these practitioners at that time. So it's interesting. Then they were developing the curriculum. So how do we teach this? So and for in terms of acupuncture, there is this professor by the name of Yang Jiasan, who wrote pretty much a lot of the modern textbooks on acupuncture. So when Dr. Wang was in school, he was more interested in theory and philosophy. So that's why he spent a lot of time, I think even he had a greater interest in herbal medicine at the time when he was a student. But at that time, there was also, there's a lot of funding to do research on the channels, to discover what are the channels. So at that time, a lot of the researchers were influenced more by Western medicine.
Right.
So the goal is, okay, so what are the channels? We have to find them. And so they took cadavers, and they were just doing anatomical dissections and trying to find what are the channels.
So it was kind of an initiative from a Western medicine point of view would you say that was?
I think so. I think at the time that was the approach at the time. So I think that's being repeated in the West nowadays.
Yeah.
Saying, the channels are the nerves, or the channels are the blood vessels, or the fascia. So that research was already being done in China decades ago.
Yeah.
So Dr. Wang, one thing he did as part of his training was that he started helping out one of the professors who did this research on cadavers, pretty much. And they're trying to find what are the channels. So when Dr. Wang graduated from university, because he did all that research on channels, he was assigned to be the head of the channel research center of a hospital in Beijing. So it's the Beijing Hospital of Chinese Medicine, which is near this, it used to be in this really old, I think Jason in his book, The Applied Channel Theory in Chinese Medicine, they talk about this, the clinic at that time for where the acupuncture clinic was, I think it was a former princess's house. So like this amazing courtyard house. But anyway, so Dr. Wang, he was working in this little office. Mm-hmm. And he was only 24 years old, just recent graduate. Oh. And he had like just a bunch of books on the channels, or on like the classics. Mm-hmm. So all he did for 6 months straight, every day he'd just be reading about the channels. Then after 6 months, he's like, wait a second, like I'm not learning anything about the channels just by reading these classics. Mm-hmm. So he said, okay, if I want to become an expert on channels, I have to have clinical experience. So at that time, when he was a student, the one thing he did not like was acupuncture.
Right.
Because he thought he had clumsy hands. So there are stories, like he told us stories, like when he was a student and Professor Yang asked him to needle a patient's Ren 12. And then he spent 20 minutes standing over the patient, trying to insert the needle into the patient. But the needle did not puncture through the skin. So then after a while, the patient started to protest and said, Professor Yang, change this student. This student is terrible. It's this so painful. So after that, Dr. Wang said, okay, my hands are too clumsy. I'm not good with my hands. Mm-hmm. So he gave up on acupuncture.
Oh, he actually gave up?
Yeah, actually, when he was a student, he was just like, he was not interested at all. He was like, I'm not good at this.
Okay.
But then when he went to the hospital to work, he realized he had to become an acupuncturist. So he started following a bunch of the acupuncturists in that hospital. You start to realize that acupuncture actually does work. It gets really good results. Mm-hmm. And so he said, okay, now I'm going to dedicate more of my energy to acupuncture. I'm going to learn acupuncture.
Yeah, interesting. What do you think he found? Like, what's the most crucial thing that he found during this research about the channels? Because, yeah, I'm interested to know. Mm-hmm.
So it goes back. So once he started treating patients, then I think he said in the earlier phase of his career as an acupuncturist was that he was influenced by all that modern research on medicine. He said at that time too, he was, I think, you know, like a lot of people when you grow up in more of like a Western, like modern science type background, your mind is, you want to feel something that's more like physical, right? Like
yeah.
that you, if you cut open the body, yeah, you can take out like this tube in the body and say, oh, that's like the channel.
Right.
So he was influenced by all the research going on at that time. So he tested it out. So like some people said, oh, the channels are the nerves. So I think for a while he was doing a lot of nerve stimulation or the channels are this or channels are that. So he started testing it out on people and using it. And sometimes he would get good results and sometimes he wouldn't. Mm-hmm. Or he would, you know, treat people according, you know, to like the textbook definition of like where these points should be located, how we should stimulate it. And the same thing, it's like sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So over that earlier phase, like this is like the 1960s, that's when he started realizing when he went back to the classics. So reading like the Neijing, you know, like the Ling Shu, the basic questions like the Suwen, books like the Jia Yi Jing, like the Nanjing, the Classic of Difficulties, and some of these other books that he likes, like the Gathering Blossoms of Acupuncture, and there's another one called I think it's called Nourishing Life, that one, yeah, Generating Life, Nourishing Life, the Jinjiu Zishengting. Once he started reading that and reading all these acupuncture poems, then he started to realize, once you start reading, understanding channels through that perspective, the classical perspective, his understanding improved, and also his clinical experience greatly improved.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's interesting because in the book, actually, he gives a very clear definition on what channels are.
Right.
So we mentioned channels as a communication network, but as a container that is, there's this nice description of the channels are the river bank, but also the river. And there's, for me, it's interesting to hear about, okay, where can we take the classical text and where do we have the modern clinical application? How much space do we have in like a modern day approach to leave space for what's mystic in that?
Right.
And did Dr. Wang, was he frustrated with the mysticism of Chinese medicine at all, like in the classical text? That's something
I don't know, because I think he grew up in a time when Chinese medicine was seen as a very practical, pragmatic thing, right? Like because you know, Chinese medicine in China was practiced in hospitals. Like you're treating actual illnesses, you're in a hospital, you have inpatient wards, outpatient wards.
Yeah.
It's like being in a Western medical hospital. So one thing that he said, okay, so the passage we're talking about that greatly influences understanding of channels and which later influenced everything else pretty much that he did, was there's this this passage in the, I think, chapter 10 of the Divine Pivot, which says that in Chinese it says the channels fusing fenrou zhijian. So the channels travel in the spaces, or we can say the divisions between the flesh. So at that time, what that meant was, like, his interpretation later was that flesh meaning like the different tissues on the surface of the body. So including like the skin, the vessels, the muscles, the sinews, and the bones. So basically what it says is that the channels travel in the spaces between these different tissues,
right.
Or what he called like the different junctions.
Yeah.
So basically it says that the channels are not the skin. Mm-hmm. They're not the vessels. They're not the nerves. They're not the blood vessels. They're not the muscles.
Between.
Yeah, they're the spaces. They're located in what he would call the crevices, the fengxi, the crevices between all these different tissues.
Yeah.
So the approach that he was doing when I said in the 1960s with that professor of like trying to actually find an actual structure, he said that was wrong, right? Because they're trying to find something in the body you could pull out, when instead the channels are in the spaces between those different structures. And that creates that pathway. Mm-hmm. So once he started to develop that understanding, then he was like, okay, now when I insert a needle, I have to insert the needle into those spaces too, those crevices. And once he started doing that, his point locations improved. He started to get better traveling sensation. And then finally, the second thing was he found for diagnostically, there's another very important quote in the classics too that says for anyone who uses needles or all acupuncturists, you can say, or you can say all Chinese medical practitioners, before you proceed with the treatment, you have to first examine the channels. You have to examine the excess or deficiency of the channels. And it goes through these different methods, right? How you can palpate, like pressing, plucking, palpating. So then he started doing that, and they said, okay, where do I palpate? How do I examine them? So one of the methods is doing this method of just palpating along the channel crevice within that space and feeling for changes.
So it's actually about, I wanted to ask mm-hmm. about the role of palpation mm-hmm. in that, and it's actually very emphasized in Dr. Wang's approach, right? Very rigorous approach to palpating the channels and getting your hands on, trying to figure out what's going on in between.
Yes, yes, yes.
And did you ever also know, like, how does that affect needling techniques?
Okay, so first of all, for the palpation, like, it really helps with our diagnosis, because then you actually are finding within the channel crevices pathological changes that occur in these channel crevices. Mm-hmm. So what we call like nodules or lumps or sticks or crispy changes, or like the surrounding structures might become very tense, or they might feel very empty mm-hmm. or loose. So it really helps with your diagnosis.
Yeah.
So as a result, it's kind of like a traditional Chinese medical, a traditional method of physical examination. So Western medical doctors do physical examination, and this is the classical physicians of Chinese medicine also did a method of physical examination, but their focus was more on the channels, right? So it just gives you more objective information, right? So it's useful, and it's something I think all practitioners should use. So that's number one. So it helps, it makes your diagnosis clearer.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly is because we say that the points are in the channels, in these crevices, that means when we needle it, once we start needling in these crevices, usually you get better sensations too.
Mm-hmm.
So like you don't even have to do any, usually as long as you accurately locate the points and you stick the needle into that exact location where the point is located, usually you get better traveling sensation. And this is not just Dr. Wang's experience. I think people who studied with Dr. Wang for a long period of time or who taken like some of our like classes on point locations, most people report, oh, now when I feel for the point in the space, the specific location, I get better traveling sensation
mm-hmm.
and my results improve too. So that's generally what most people say when they do better accurate location of the points. Because in school, they often say, oh, where are the points? So they do like the bone measurements.
Yeah.
That just gives you a general idea where the points are, but you still have to be more specific, right? So where is it exactly? So each point is located within these spaces between these different tissues. So we have to really like palpate and find that exact depression within that crevice.
And do you feel like it's more geared towards detecting deficiency or excess?
Do you mean the palpation or?
Yeah.
Both.
Both, okay.
Right. So basically whenever we see patients, one is how do we diagnose a patient? On the one hand, we have to always interpret a patient's symptoms, like mm-hmm. their symptom patterns. That always helps us understand if they have excess or deficiency, right? So you still have to do the traditional diagnosis of asking questions, looking at the tongue, checking the pulse. That gives you a general idea of the pathology. Like you can think, oh, is it more like heart qi deficiency? Or we talk more about like channel theory. So could it be like, for example, the tai yin system has deficiency or stagnation or dampness. And then we palpate the channel. So then you combine what you're finding from palpation. So sometimes you can feel, if there's deficiency, it might feel very empty mm-hmm. in the channel space. Sometimes at specific points, like the source points, for example, you might feel more changes there. It could be empty or little nodules or sticks that can indicate potentially that there's deficiency. And there's stagnation, maybe you feel more like nodules or lumps or tightness along the channel. That's a sign of stagnation, possibly, or excess. But then you still always have to combine what you're finding in the channels with the patient's symptoms. So it's, you can't completely only rely on what you're feeling. You also have to incorporate the channel examination, the symptom patterns too.
Do you think the rigorousness or the specifics of figuring that out is something that Dr. Wang really kind of brought back into Chinese approaches of applied channel theory?
I think everyone, like the people who are like super hardcore fans of applied channel theory, like these two individuals here, we would say yes. And that because like these methods of palpation, like physically palpating your patients, was at least in China, because over the centuries Chinese culture became more and more conservative. So like especially during the Qing dynasty, so there are a lot of rules where they you're forbidden to physically touch your patients.
Right.
So that's why these methods of palpation were lost over the centuries. So if you watch any Chinese movies, like I'm sure some people have seen them, where you watch a lot of Chinese soap operas based on like the royalty and things like that. So like, the, for example, the princess or the concubine or the empress, she has to go get treated by a doctor. So what they do is like the doctor is sitting here, and then they have like a silk screen separating the patient from the doctor, and then there's a little hole cut in the the screen where the female patient can stick her hand through there
to do pulsing.
Yeah, and they can do only the pulsing. You can touch this, that's okay. But the most extreme is like if it's the empress, so the empress has to sit all the way over in that room. They take that silk string, put it wrap it around her wrist, and pull it into this room, and then the doctor palpates the silk. That's an extreme example, right?
Yeah.
So basically, the idea is that like palpation was lost over the centuries, at least in the, within like the wealthier classes, maybe within like the folk society,
right,
amongst the commoners, maybe people still did palpation.
Yeah.
Which I think Dr. Wang did observe when he went to, in the 1960s, another thing he did was that he...
About Dr. Wang's understanding of De Qi.
So his understanding of De Qi is different from maybe what we learned in the textbooks. So a lot of textbooks say you're just getting soreness or like a feeling of like distension. Or that tingling, those are all good signs of De Qi. But Dr. Wang, his understanding of De Qi was like you have to get the tingling sensation, a traveling sensation. But that traveling sensation, in ideal situations, is like a very gentle, slow traveling sensation. So a little bit different from that nervy, electric sensation. But his requirement was, for example, if we use needle distal points, like below the elbows and knees, for example, we needle the husi points, the idea of the qi sensation is a tingling sensation that would go all the way down. Like, for example, you needle lung 5, you should get a sensation at least to the wrist. Right? If you needle PC3, it should go down at least to the wrist. Same with heart 3. If you needle lung 9, you should get a traveling sensation to the palms, to the hands. And it should, generally speaking, in the ideal situation, would be more of like a gentle tingling sensation. So, because in the classics, they say that, like, when the qi arrives, then the illness improves. So there, so that was his main requirement. But then to get that De Qi sensation, it wasn't necessarily based on your technique. It's more about, I would say, the most important thing is the accurate location of the point. So you locate the point accurately, then generally speaking, you'll get the De Qi sensation. And then he would say that over time, as your technique improves, like the sensitivity in your hands improves, then you can sometimes, in certain cases, you can add certain techniques to improve the sensation. But then some points are more electric than others, but spleen 6 sometimes, or kidney 3 or kidney 7 can sometimes be more, or bladder 40. But most of the points he was trying to get this like nice gentle sensation traveling down. I think Dr. Wang's experience was that when the practitioner feels the change in the point while you're needling it, usually the patient will also have a response. So it's like the two together.
Yeah.
So I know that some people, they just stick it in, they feel something, and then they say, that's it. But for Dr. Wang, he had to, on the one in the hands, usually you could feel something, and then the patient will also be like, yeah, got it. You know, like, so there are a lot of times, like when it's patients who spend a lot of time with them, or like, they'd be like, yep, got it. It went down to my ankle. Oh, yeah, got it. And Dr. Wang would also be like, yep, he would feel it too. Usually he could tell when he was getting the right, needling the point the right way.
But it's not like the practitioner has to feel it in his hands.
I would say you don't necessarily have to. Like especially when we're starting out, when your hands aren't as sensitive, like the most important thing you can rely on is what the patient is feeling, reporting.
Just to conclude, I thought it would be nice to just talk a bit about the courses you're going to teach, especially in terms of depression and anxiety, because that's something you said that you definitely feel like in Beijing is becoming more, there's more patients with with depressive and anxiety patterns coming now. Mm-hmm. And in your course description, you mentioned the you.
Oh, that character you, yes.
The character you. And I felt that it might be something interesting to...
Discuss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just now. In so the that, last
was one,
couple
like, that was one of the terms that... So in Chinese, there's this character you. Why you with the... I think if the fourth term,
the
you,
first,
right?
Yeah.
So when I was translating Dr. Wang's... There are two cases in the case studies book on this treatment of, like... I guess you could say they're suffering from some kind of depression or anxiety, some kind of emotional type of issues. So when I was translating, some of the characters we used were... He would use was the character you. So I was like, okay, Dr. Wang, how do we understand this character? Like, how is it different from... another term we call is like stagnation, like zhi, right? Teacher, that zhi, that character.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference between these two characters? And then it led to this whole discussion, and it was really fascinating for me. So I used to, what would happen is like usually after the clinic would end in the mornings, and then he would take we'd have lunch, he would take his afternoon nap. Then after he woke up from his afternoon nap, I would bother him with a lot of questions. And then one of them was like, what is you? And then, so we're sitting in his small clinic room like this. Mm-hmm. It was the middle of summer and it was really hot and he didn't like turning on the AC. So he had this little, like the window, I think, was open up just a crack, and he had this little fan that goes, zzz. And then he was just telling me, he's like, okay, so the you is this kind of feeling of things are just kind of stuck within. There's like, things are just stuck. And there's like in a muggy room. He's like, just like this room right now. It's like really muggy. It's kind of like humid and it's hard to breathe. That kind of feeling. But you can't actually see it, right? Mm-hmm. It's not visible to the eye. So this is kind of, but he says kind of like this in terms of emotions, this is kind of emotional stuffiness,
mm-hmm.
or stagnation, mm-hmm. in a way.
Yeah.
But then, so we can say that in terms of the channels themselves can experience this kind of you, and like this kind of, we call it, translated to English as constraint. Like, things are just kind of not circulating properly.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the character, like, the simple way it's written in simplified Chinese to the way it's written, I guess, more in, like, traditional Chinese, is different. So if you look at the traditional Chinese, it's like if you were to look out this window and you look at this forest here, or these bushes, that is what the you character was describing.
Mm-hmm.
So things are kind of all bunched together. You can't see this really dense forest and you can't really find your way through. And then we could interpret it according to, like, emotions, right? It's that kind of emotional constraint, stuffiness, stuck. Or they said another way they would describe it is, I don't know if you can see, if we look out into the sky and we see the clouds, you know when you see those clouds are, right, white, billowy clouds?
Mm-hmm.
That's also, they would describe that's like a you kind of idea. Or they would describe you as in terms of describing different kinds of something really strong fragrance,
mm-hmm.
or aroma.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of thick, dense smell to it.
So something that is... overwhelming in a way,
I don't know if it's overwhelmed, but it's kind of mugginess, heaviness,
mm-hmm.
things are kind of stuck.
Yeah.
So then later, later in Chinese medicine, they start to use this to describe, in terms of the zangfu, they talk about zangfu more like constraint due to the emotions. So emotional constraint that would affect the normal qi dynamic or functioning of the organs. So doctor would say, okay, how that yu affects the qi dynamic of the channels.
Right.
So then he talked about there are different kinds of constraint.
Mm-hmm.
So one could be due to excess and one could be due to deficiency. So what we see is like when it's excess, like usually that can lead to like that qi stagnation.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that oftentimes in the Shaoyang channel system,
mm-hmm.
which is related to the Sanjiao and the gallbladder, right? So that's more, that Sanjiao, from Dr. Wang's perspective, is related to the circulation of qi in the body, right? It's a pathway for qi.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's like Shaoyang qi stagnation, constraint, right? You're under a lot of stress, you have a lot of, then you get like pressure here,
mm-hmm.
here you get pressure in the chest, maybe the hypochondriac pain, headaches, those types of patients, then we say we can release constraint by regulating the Shaoyang, right? By using,
mm-hmm.
he would use Sanjiao 6 GB34 as a main point. But then the flip side would be people who have constraint due to deficiency, like qi deficiency, there's no qi, right? Less qi, so it's not moving things.
Mm-hmm.
That can also lead to constraint too. And he saw that in a lot of patients with the Shaoyin system, so the heart and kidney.
Mm-hmm.
So he would use, in those patients, they might have signs of deficiency too, like coldness in the hands and feet, insomnia, poor sleep, maybe heart palpitations, coldness in the back, coldness in the limbs. Those patients he would use like the Shaoyin channel to regulate that. So using like heart 7, kidney 3. So then what we're doing in that case, we're tonifying qi, warming yang to release constraint. And the one in the Shaoyang, we use like the Sandra 6 GB34 to move qi or dredge qi to release constraint. So
okay.
It's kind of this difference between yin and yang.
Okay, but that's something that he kind of observed, but the general concept of you, it doesn't relate to any specific meridians, right? It's kind of just, it feels like more like an atmosphere almost, or like a condition that Dr. Yes. Wang then related to Xiaoyang. And
yeah, so the you can affect different channels depending on the individual. Okay. So we see like over the years, like you were mentioning, like in Beijing recently, you know, we see patients who have constraint related to the Yangming, or constraint related to the Taiyin, or constraint related to the Xiaoyang, Xiaoyin, all of them, right, can have experienced constraint.
Yeah, yeah. And the other character that you mentioned was, so there's Yu and
That's stagnation. That's more something where we see it's more like, you know, that stagnation, things are blocked there. And
right, the, okay.
But Yu is more something you might not be able to visibly see, right? Yeah. It's kind of like an aroma, fragrance, something. But something is just kind of stuck and not moving properly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an helpful kind of image to apply to the patterns of anxiety or depression.
And in modern Chinese, when we talk about depression, they also use that character Yu, right? They call it Yu, right? Yu Zhong. So they use that same character. Yeah. So over time, like that terminology originally was described these kind of trees or forests or those kind of clouds, billowy clouds. Now instead, it was over time used to describe an emotional state.
Yeah, and a mood almost.
Like, some feeling melancholy, sadness, kind of things are kind of stuck.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, no problem.
And there's going to be more on this on tomorrow and on Friday.
Yeah, tomorrow, Friday. And we'll probably do some palpation too in some of the classes.
Yeah. Okay.
That's it. Do you have any questions?
Okay,
that's it. Nice to meet everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.